Broadcast of the Economic Club of Indiana Speaker Series is made possible in part by ProLiance Energy. ProLiance, adding power to energy. Information is at ProLiance.com.
Welcome to the Economic Club of Indiana Luncheon Series. Today's speaker is Rebecca Ryan, the founder of Next Generation Consulting. Ryan's company specializes in dealing with one of Indiana's biggest problems, brain drain. She works with companies to attract and keep 20-somethings in the community and keep them interested in making the community a better place. She says these young men and women are also known as millennials. Millennials are interested in culture, arts, public transportation, and green issues. Ryan says these millennials make a city economically viable and productive.
Hey, forget about a work-life balance. For the next generation, it's the other way around. A life-work balance. That's one of the trends identified by brain drain expert Rebecca Ryan, founder of Next Generation Consulting. She started her company in 1998 as a frustrated Gen Xer who herself had had 5 jobs in 4 years after finishing college. She decided something needed to be done to transition from baby boomer workforce to the next generation. Labeled a hip doctor, and that's not like the orthopedic replacement. Ryan helps communities become hip, cool places to live so they can attract the next wave of young professionals. Her company does market research among young people to pinpoint what they're looking for in a community or a workplace. The 7 indices used to see if a community measures up are vitality, earning, learning, social capital, cost of lifestyle, after hours, and around town. She wrote about her firm's findings in the book Live First, Work Second. Ryan says with so many career paths to choose, the next generation needs to be reassured that there's no right way. Instead, you should do the next thing in your path, and your path becomes clearer. She likens it to her favorite Zen Buddhist quotation, chop wood, carry water. The U.S. Association for Small Business and Entrepreneurship named Rebecca the 2004 Entrepreneur of the Year, and she is Woman in Communications 2006 Communicator of the Year. Ryan says her definition of success is, it's learning, loving, and laughing, having good conversations with smart people, being active, and eating and drinking well, a viable means by which to make a living. Her speech today is entitled Brain Drain, Brain Gain, Getting Inside the Minds of the Next Generation. I've had the pleasure to hear her several times, and I know you're going to enjoy it, so please welcome Rebecca Ryan.
First of all, I want to start with a giant apology to you people. It's true that I have no good sides, but you are getting the worst of all the bad sides. So, jeepers. I'm going to talk about a couple of things today. I'm going to talk about airplanes, I'm going to talk about potatoes, and I might talk about diapers if I have time. And the reason I have a degree in economics is mostly because I majored in one professor. Those of you who are in higher education, you know how this works. Sometimes you just want to take every class from a certain professor, and then you end up with a degree in that department, and that's what happened to me. I just took every class that Dr. Hughes offered, and I ended up with an econ degree at the end of it. But one of the things I always loved about Dr. Hughes is he would sometimes say, he would put a crazy picture up, and he would say, now I know you're wondering how economics is tied to this picture, but hang with me for a second, and I'll connect the dots. So you might be wondering how are airplanes and potatoes and maybe diapers, right, attached to the topic of brain drain or brain gain. If you just hang with me long enough, I'll try to work some Dr. Hughes magic. The first question really is, you know, we're talking today about brain drain, brain gain. Why do we even care? You know, a lot of people are saying, you know, we're saying in Indiana, our number one export is educated young people. I don't know who started this, but the governor of Wisconsin says the same thing. I've heard it from Janet Neapolitano in Arizona. Like, every state's best export is their educated young talent, right? Why is everybody so interested in the next generation? I think I can make this really simple for you. It's about 3 things. The first one is something that this gentleman, Peter Drucker, wrote about in 2002. He passed away in 2007, and in his last book, he wrote this. He said, in developed countries, that's us, right? The number one issue that we're facing is this: rapid growth in the older generation and the shrinking of the younger generation, right? So we've got more boomers and fewer people behind them, but some of you don't want to read it and listen to it. Some of you are visual learners, so I brought a map. Find Indianapolis on the map. Can you see it? See it? 1950... You've got your eye on Indianapolis, right? What color is it? Pink, right? Some of you are like, it's fuchsia. It's, you know, sherbet, rainbow raspberry sherbet. Right. So you see Indianapolis, 1950, pink means we were having about 2.4 births per household, right? Now, keep your eye on the map. Find yourself now. Here's 2000. What color are you, Indianapolis? Blue. That means you're having fewer than 2.1 births per household, which means that, and boy, it wasn't just Indianapolis that turned pink. Pretend I'm your eye doctor for just a second. Lens one, lens two. Lens one, lens two. As Drucker pointed out, every developed country started to have fewer kids after 1950, which has caused fewer knowledge workers. But that's not the only reason we're talking about brain drain. Check this out. Market capitalizations as of last Friday for these four companies. Right? Market capitalizations. Here is the market capitalization of Google. You can total up General Motors and Ford and Lockheed Martin and Boeing. You can total them all up and they don't add up to the market capitalization of Google. That is some crazy business. Right? What does Google manufacture? I stumped a bunch of smarties in the middle of the country. Right, Google manufactures what? Information? Maybe? Or they manufacture the feeling that you don't know how to spell, that's for sure. Right? Switch the I and the E and something, and they're like, did you mean hmm? And you're like, as a matter of fact, I did. Thank you. Raise your hand if you've Googled today. Keep your hand up if this week you have ego-Googled where you type your own name in the listings to see where you come up. Uh-huh. I see you. I see you. Right? This is a really interesting slide. I think in one slide, this is my way of showing how my dad's economy, that production, that goods-based economy, has shifted to a knowledge-based economy. Warren Buffett was recently asked, when General Motors was crazily valued at $4 billion in market capitalization, which is probably like 2 weeks ago, right? Warren was asked, you know, he had, at the time, billions and billions of dollars just laying, you know, in his closet, I'm not sure, in the trunk of his 98 Taurus that he still drives. I'm not sure, anyway. Warren was asked by Charlie Rose, Warren, you have a bazooka amount of money laying around. Why don't you just buy General Motors? It's only $4 billion. And you know what Warren said? Warren said, I can't figure out the General Motors business. At which time, Charlie Rose looked at him like he had a learning disability and said, what do you mean you don't understand General Motors business? It's a car company. And Warren's like, I get that part. He's like, but to my mind, General Motors is actually a giant annuity company. And it has a little car division attached to it. Right? How the economy has shifted. How the economy has shifted. But the other thing we know about the next generation is that how they're making choices shifts too. And here's where I want to talk a little bit about airplanes. Jim Walters is the vice president, senior vice president of human resources at Cessna Aircraft Company, and their headquarters is in Wichita, Kansas. Now, wrap your head around Jim's challenge. Jim is in charge of staffing the super smart engineers who preferably love flight and airplanes who are going to come to Wichita, Kansas. Can you see how his, like, funnel is just going to the narrowest piece? So first he needs engineers. In our country we're graduating about 70,000 a year. India is graduating 100,000 a year and China is graduating over 200,000 a year, right? So first he's looking at the engineering funnel. And then he's saying, preferably I want engineers who love flight, who love aircraft design. Okay, so that's a little bit of us. And then I want the ones who really want to live in Wichita, Kansas, right? Now, Jim's biography is that he is Canadian. Prior to coming to Cessna, he worked for Green, right? He worked for John Deere in Rock Island, Illinois. He's used to working in a global environment. His wife is from Italy, and he has two sons. And the story continues. Son number two is in his fifth year of a four-year degree and is expected to graduate in May. Jim was on the phone recently with his son, and he said, "Son, we're really looking forward to your graduation." You could almost feel Jim's wallet breathe a sigh of relief. And he said, "Son, we're really looking forward to your graduation. What are your plans after college?" And his son said to him, "Well, I'm thinking about moving to Italy." And Jim said to his son, "Son, that is the answer to a different question." In that story, we've got all the elements of brain drain, don't we? We have a global demand for knowledge workers. We have parents who would really like to see their kids be successful. And we've got kids who are saying, "My definition of success and my next steps after college might look different than yours do." This is why the title of my book is Live First, Work Second, because for the next generation, much like Jim's son, where they live is as important as where they work, and often it's the first choice they make, right? Our research shows that half of all people between the ages of 20 and 40 say that where I live is as important as where I work. And if you look at people under the age of 28, that goes up to 75%. 75%. I remember when Governor Vilsack, who was the governor at the time in the state of Iowa, he called and he said, Rebecca — it wasn't him, actually, it was somebody on his staff — called and said, "Rebecca, we're looking for an expert who can help us keep talent in Iowa." Now, I lived in Iowa for 10 years. I went to Drake University, right? And I said to him, "What are you thinking, like Great Wall of China? Are you thinking like parole bracelets? Like what? Help me. Help me know what you're talking about here." And he said, "Oh, maybe you can't help us." And he hung up, and a couple weeks later he called back and he said, "Well, what are your thoughts about keeping young people in Iowa?" Because Governor Vilsack had campaigned on the notion that there were more people over the age of 70 than under the age of 4. And I said, "Well, you know what? I think it's inevitable that the next generation is going to leave Iowa. And frankly, I think it's a good thing." Right? Iowans need to leave Iowa. Hoosiers also need to leave Indiana. But the key is then, after they hit that magic 28th birthday or that magic 29th birthday, that we are connected with them and know how to invite them back. Right? It's that the Italians have a proverb for it. They say, "When a child is born, so is a grandmother." So when our next generation hits the magic age of 28, they have their first starter marriage, they start thinking about having kids. You heard that, starter marriage, yep. That's the time, right? That's the time when we have to pounce. And so in Iowa, what we did was we got all the colleges and universities to collaborate. And they shared their mailing lists. And we did a full court press to people who were at that magical age, post-28, who were no longer living in the state of Iowa. Governor went out and did Iowa parties, blew the doors off of places. It's amazing how people who left wanted to know what was happening in Iowa, and coupled it with a website called smartcareermove.com. Right? Now, the last I've heard, 750 Iowans have moved back to Iowa as a result of that initiative. And you might be thinking, 750, please. Can I tell you, Iowa only has 2.4 million people in it. 750 makes a difference. Right? This is like the rule of small numbers, okay? So we also know that as the next generation is pushing their adulthood back, right, they're skeptical about, you know that more 25 to 40-year-olds believe that they will see a UFO than receive Social Security? Can I get an amen from anybody who agrees with that? Okay, I rest my case. So we've got a younger, so here's, you know, what we've got. We've got, Drucker says we've got declining demographics. We've got a smaller pool of people. We know that the economy is saying that the rewards of the new economy, the knowledge-based economy, right, are going to go to those who are working in a knowledge-based economy. And now we've got a next generation who, like Jim's kid, has different priorities. What do we do? Is brain drain inevitable? What do we do to attract, retain, and engage them? Now, we've only talked to 30,000 young professionals. We might not know what we're talking about, which is why I brought backup. I brought the fairy job mother. Okay? Here's what he says.
"I'm your fairy job mother."
"So, you're taking that job out west, huh? Come here.
nuts? Come on!
This is what you can afford out west!
Look at this!
This is what you can afford here!
Good, huh?
Double time! Come on!
Programming, chip design, biotech, this place is crawling with them!
Check out Pennsylvania at InventPA.com.
Do that?
No earthquake!
You know, this is important for a couple reasons that, frankly, tie to diapers and potatoes. This, as you might imagine, was not an ad that was created by the governor's office, even though they put their insignia on it. This was an ad that was created by young people for other young people, right? Which was a pretty bold move, because not a lot of economic development or workforce development people think like, ad to attract and retain young talent, heavy man, tutu. Right? Not a lot of people think that. But for the next generation, right, for whom it's about stories, it's about humor, it's about intrigue, it's about reaching them where they're at, it made all kinds of sense, right? So we've got this sort of new equation here. And the question for us is, how do we in Indianapolis, how do we in the state of Indiana keep and attract a smaller generation of knowledge workers, right, a smaller generation of smarties, who have different preferences and for whom the economy has changed, for whom the economy has fundamentally changed, right? This is what I want to talk about next. I think really it starts with intentional design. And when I talk about intentional design, let me share an anecdote that's not about intentional design. A friend of mine, Jim Armstrong, used to work for an advertising agency. And during the time that he was working with this agency, they had a client that shall remain nameless, but they sell diapers. And so what happens very often in advertising agencies is you interact with the product and you try to like figure out like what are the brand attributes of the product that you can sell and market. And Jim said that he had a real sort of come to the mountain moment when he realized that it was him and a bunch of other men who had never changed a nappy. Right? Who had never changed a diaper, who were like interacting with this diaper and trying to figure out how to sell this diaper to women. And he's, you know, who buy the diapers. And he said, in that moment, I realized that we did not have integrity as an agency. And he left and he started his own thing. Intentional design is the exact opposite of that. It is intentional design brings the true intention, right, the purpose of what it is you're trying to accomplish and matches it with the design. And I had a very personal experience with intentional design recently that I want to briefly share with you. In 2006, I built a house, and it's the first house I've ever built, hopefully ever will build, and I had a certain set of values that were sort of my true north around this. One of them was I wanted it to have a low environmental footprint. I wanted it to be as carbon neutral as possible, as energy efficient as possible. I was open to using reused materials, reclaimed materials. But I also wanted it to be very modern and be a place that I wanted to live in for the rest of my life. So it had to have a lot of natural light and all these other things. Luckily, I found an architect who was willing to build this kind of a house and who had experience with this kind of a house. And one of the first things he did to me was he gave me a 34-question questionnaire, and he said, fill this out. And after you fill this out, we'll start working on your blueprints. And there were a lot of questions in here about how the house was going to be used, and what he was trying to get at was intent. What was my intent? What were my values? And this question stumped me. He said, what do you want to be homesick for? Boy, that's a great question. That gets at intent, doesn't it? That gets at purpose. And this is the question that took me the longest to fill out. It was the question that remained blank. But finally, I figured it out, and I wrote this. Which I think disappointed Chris. Because I think he was thinking I was going to say, like, oh, the bright light or the water feature or, you know, whatever crazy business he thought he was going to magically, you know, do. And but I told him my dogs, and he accepted the answer, and he said, tell me more about that. And I said, well, the house I live in right now, my dogs can't see me, and I can't see them, and I've got two labs, and they get that crazy mohawk on the back, like they're really honked off. You know, when people come to the door, and it's kind of, when you come home from a trip, the last thing you want to see is dogs that look like they're going to rip your lips off, you know? So I told him, you know, I want to be homesick for my dogs. I want to have this more happy homecoming. So we moved in August of 2006. This is my home. And I know it's a little hard to see here, but Joey and Zach, the yellow and the black lab, are looking through what we call the quick trip door. This was part of Chris's solution, was to put these full glass doors on our home, but he didn't stop there. You can see on the second level, they can see me through the guest room, they can see me from the hallway, and they can see me from just off the office's little porch there. And as I have woken up in this home now for mornings and days since we've been in it, the intention that Chris put into this design isn't just about being able to see my dogs and be homesick for my dogs. It's how I live in and experience the home every single day. Boy, for that first month, I would wake up and all I could see were trees in my room, even though I live in a neighborhood. I've got a house 10 feet away from me on one side and probably 15 on the other side. Never saw my neighbor's homes, only saw the trees because of how Chris had placed the windows in the home. That is the power of intentional design, which leads me to this question, right? How do we intentionally design a city or a region or a state or a company offer that the next generation will engage with because it just fits them hand in glove like this home fits me? I think the first thing is that it would be fair to say that if we were going to start with a blank piece of paper today, a piece of paper where Indianapolis is competing in a knowledge-based economy for a shrinking demographic of younger workers, we might not build the city as it currently is. We might do things a little bit differently, right? And we might do some things the same. We might turn up the volume on a few things and mute others, right? That would be fair to say. But what we've spent the last 10 years doing at my firm, Next Generation Consulting, is trying to see cities and see companies through that lens of the next generation, to see and feel and experience what they're seeing and feeling and experiencing so that we can intentionally design a better offer, a better experience. Right? Now, it all starts right here. This is your brain. Well, not yours. I mean, yours probably isn't this big. This is really big brain. I mean, you probably have big brains. I'm just saying, you know, your head would have to be as big as that screen to hold a brain that big. Anyway, sometimes people say to me, Rebecca, how do you know if a community is going to thrive or whether it's not? How do you know whether a company is going to be able to attract and retain the people that it needs? And the truth is, I don't always know. I don't always know. But this is a leading indicator. It's how people are thinking. It's how people are thinking. It's about this brain right here. So, for example, if a community has a group of economic development professionals for whom their part of the brain is saying it's just about jobs, it's just about jobs, it's just about jobs, they probably are behind in the race for talent. Likewise, okay, because here's how the handoff happens. If the ED people are out there saying, attract the jobs, bring the jobs, bring the jobs, they hand the jobs off to the companies, right? And then if you have leaders of companies whose brains are working saying that talent is an expense that we can cut to boost profits, right? There again, you've got some crazy mixed up thinking in your brain, right? And just to put it in perspective right now, because we're in this sort of, well, sort of, we are in a soft economy. Rebecca receives the Understatement of the Year Award, December 2008. Right, we're in a soft economy. And what does Uncle Warren say? Uncle Warren says, when the market gets greedy, I get fearful. And when the market gets fearful, I get greedy. Which is another way of saying buy and sell. Right. But what do most businesses do when the race is on for talent? When no one can find any talent, they're willing to buy? Right. And then when economic downturn comes, they sell that talent low. What smart companies are doing right now is they're doing what Uncle Warren is doing with stocks. They are looking around and they are saying, everything is on sale! we need, right? Cherry pick, cherry pick, cherry pick. Right? They're also doing other smart things. I was just on an executive panel on Saturday at El Verno College, which is also run by the School Sisters of St. Francis, very similar to our sister here today. And at this executive panel, I got to hear from, everybody was being asked about the economy, and I got to hear from somebody who is so much wiser than me, Mark McSweeney. He said, this is the third economic downturn I've been through. He's just retired. He said, let me tell you what we did during the first one. Big mistake. He said, what we did was, we gave everyone the bonuses as we had planned to, right? And then what happened was all of our good talent, the first economic downturn, they gave no bonuses. They said, sorry, economic downturn, no bonuses. He said, all of our good talent left, and all of the crappy talent stayed. We say that in Wisconsin, crap is not a swear word in Wisconsin. Crap is like something you drive around in the road if the farmers have just moved the cattle. I'm just saying, okay? So it's just an agricultural reality. So he said, so all the bad talent stayed, and then when the market rebounded, all we had was crappy talent to put on jobs. So he said, then we got smart in the second downturn. What we did was, we gave all of our high performers bonuses, we didn't give any of our low performers bonuses, and encouraged them to transition, right? Our high performers stayed, and when the market rebounded, we were good to go. Right? So he said, I'm retired now, but I hope those dorks back at the ranch do it right this time. Now, when you think about the brain, the thinking that goes into creating an intentionally designed workplace experience, an intentionally designed community experience, often the things that are common sense aren't right. It's kind of like businesses who say, oh, I want to do a best practice study. Is it just me, or if everybody's doing best practices, they become average practices? You know, I very often don't see the logic in how people are thinking about wanting to do what other people are doing. That doesn't differentiate you. It doesn't get you out of the pile. It makes you average, right? So what do communities do when they don't want to be just average? Steve mentioned the seven dimensions that we measure when we look at communities, vitality, earning, learning. And what this is, all this is us looking at your community through the lens of the next generation, because these are the seven things that the next generation looks at and thinks about, and this is how they vote with their feet, right? And in gray there is an average community. This is Austin, Texas's handprint. Austin, Texas has made a lot of smart investments in the right places. I had an opportunity to speak with Angelou Angelos, who was one of the people who worked for the city of Austin before Austin was cool. And I said, Angelou, how did you guys know what to do? You know, like, as we look at your handprint in Austin, Texas, you guys are doing so many things right. It's no wonder you're like a hub for the next generation. And you know what Angelou told me? He said, Rebecca, we didn't know any better. We just did the things that we thought we should do. And the results felt like a giant accident. Now, to me, that is a story of approaching community development, economic development, talent attraction, retention, with fresh eyes. Not to do what's always been done, but to do a few things that you're just not sure how these are going to play out, but they seem like the right things to do. Let me give you another example of a community that in its day, right, before it grew like a crazy, crazy community, had a handprint about as big as Austin's. It is Atlanta, Georgia. Atlanta, Georgia has had some pretty marked contraction in a few of these indexes. And just to come back to Austin for a second, vitality measures a community's commitment to green space and commitment to citizens' health and wellness. For example, Nashville, Tennessee, when we did their handprint, they had a pretty good score in this. And the mayor at the time said, you know what, I control the whole park and rec budget. I'm going to put every single citizen of Nashville within a 10-minute walk of a public park, trail, or recreation area. Right? Earning, this one is self-explanatory. Right? Are there jobs available? And if there aren't jobs available, is there an entrepreneurial vibe in the community? You know, between 30 and 60% of the next generation consider themselves entrepreneurs. It depends who you ask, right? But between 30 and 60% of them consider themselves entrepreneurs. So is Indianapolis a community where it's not only okay to fail, but it's encouraged, right? Because that is one of the keys that has made Austin what it is. Austin is a very fail-safe community. If you fail once, it's like, all right, well, what are you going to do next? It's not suddenly you're banished from every board of directors and nobody talks to you, right? Next thing down here, the learning component. This isn't just K-12 schools, although those are important. But in this component, we're also looking at how do the colleges and universities get their giant-brained professors and researchers out into the community to talk about what they know, right? How do all the people in the community have an opportunity to get their brain battery sharpened even more? What about cost of lifestyles? Is this a place where I can afford to live? Now, here's one thing I want every city councilor, every county commissioner to hear. Young professionals aren't migrating to communities that have the lowest taxes. When we talk to young professionals about, you know, what do you think about taxes? They're like, what do you mean, what do I think about taxes? Well, you live in Minneapolis, Minnesota, or you live in San Francisco, like, you pay crazy taxes. They said, for us, it's about value. What do I get for my tax dollars? And that's some of the discussion that needs to change across this country. Because we are not going to get better schools, we are not going to get bridges that don't collapse, we are not going to get better rail systems by continuing to pay fewer and fewer taxes. Right? This is an old conversation that needs to be put on a track for the 21st century. Final two things here, after hours and around town. What's there to do after 5? That's your after hours index. We were working in Fort Dodge, Iowa, and one of the young professionals there said, well, in Fort Dodge, what there is to do after 5 is drive home. Some of the things that you guys are doing so smartly is you're connecting. You're after it, right? So the arts and cultural trail. You're connecting the things that there are to do after 5 on weekends, right? And then finally, the around town index. How easy is it to get around town? How many minutes am I going to spend in traffic? On average, Americans are now spending 21.7 minutes in traffic one way. One way. So what's your commute like? Are you below the average? Are you above the average? Are people encouraged to use mass transportation, right? Because these are what the cities of the future are investing in. Okay? Now, I want to just briefly talk about how the arts figure in here. On a very philosophical level, what arts and cultural experiences do for your communities is what they do for their knowledge workers. You know, my dad, he worked for 33 years in a row for the West Bend Company. He was on his feet all day long. When he came home from work, he sat in, what was the most famous recliner sold during my dad's era? Lazy Boy, that's it. He got in his Lazy Boy recliner. He was not a lazy boy, but he got in his Lazy Boy recliner. He popped the top on a Miller, and he, like, wanted to watch the game, right? He had been active all day long. But for your next generation of knowledge workers, what are they doing all day for activity? Paper jockeys? Like, I don't know. Right, they're sitting, they're doing what we're doing. We're doing butt time, right? So after hours, they want to get out, they want to get around, right? And the arts give them one option to do that. Now, the other reason that the arts are important is because your brain, in a knowledge-based economy, and by the way, in the United States, 33% of all workers are engaged in knowledge-based work, but those workers are bringing home over 50% of all the wages in this country. Peter Drucker predicted this in 1959. He said knowledge workers will command the wealth in our communities, and indeed they have, right? Now, so as knowledge workers, we're working with our brains all day, and the quality of our brain work is based on our ability to think creative thoughts, right? And that is a direct play around arts and culture. Right? It is a direct play around the beauty of hearing a story, whether it's a symphonic story, right, or a story told on a theater stage, whether it is doing some crazy interactive art, whether it is seeing public art. I have to tell you, when I flew into the airport, I've been coming up to Indianapolis for 4 years now because we've been working with the Arts Council through the generous support of the Lilly Endowment. And yesterday I got in at 9, and I literally freaked out for a second. I thought I was in the wrong city. Has anybody done that when you come flown into the airport? So what I want to do first is give you a huge, giant high five for investing in an infrastructure piece that is so important for this knowledge-based economy, which is global. So rock on. But point two, your commitment to art in that space blew my mind. I can't tell you how many people who were behind me getting off the plane were like, would you move? Would you get? Because there I was with my iPhone, like, taking pictures of all the art, you know? I'm like, oh, my God, this is fabulous. So But I'm getting off on a tangent here. But that's some of the importance about arts in a knowledge-based economy. And furthermore, when you look at where these knowledge-based workers are relocating, they're relocating to the commitment to the communities that are making commitments in the things that matter to them, right? So, Atlanta actually is a really good segue to this. Told you I was going to talk about potatoes. I have to read this quote because I don't want to get it wrong. It's a quote out of a, you know, Atlanta was the shizzle 15 years ago, and it still is the shizzle. But as it has gotten bigger, as it has gotten so big, and you're starting to sit in like 2 hours of traffic, an hour and 40 minutes of traffic to go 11 miles, it's becoming a harder city to live in, right? Which is why some of its handprint that I showed you a moment ago is contracting, right? But let me tell you a little story that not many people know about Atlanta. This is a quote. In 1962, 111 Atlanta arts patrons died in a plane crash at Orly Field in Paris. The victims were Atlanta Art Association members who had chartered a plane to hear their city's orchestra play in Paris. They were Atlanta's leaders, its judges, executives, and many of the old money folks. They were the establishment. They were Atlanta's blue bloods. And then one day, they were all dead. Now, we have worked in a number of communities, and always when we work in communities, we engage the next generation in the dialogue. And we ask, you know, does this community offer what you love? If you could wave a magic wand and do something different, what would that look like, right? And how many times have we heard young people say, who has to die in this community before I can get a seat at the table? Right? Now, that's sort of an embarrassed chuckle on some of our parts, but these are real concerns that the next generation has, and it's a real concern I have because of this. In Ireland, the potato famine occurred because Ireland's farmers were growing one kind of potato, and when the virus hit that potato, the entire crop was wiped out. Scientists call it a lack of genetic diversity. And if a species does not have genetic diversity, it does not have sustainability. Genetic diversity makes a species, it really helps, make it sort of kill-proof, it's kind of insurance against for perpetuation of the species. And how many times when we work in communities do we see all the same people on all the same boards? We had a project in Florida where I went in to sort of do a presentation on the handprint, and it seemed like everybody knew each other. So at one point I said to this guy, I said, did you guys all go to high school together? Like, what's going on here? And he said, in our community, the same 100 people run everything. And you know what I thought of? First of all, I thought, I hope you all carpool, because I know that we're just going to the next, you know, community board meeting. Get on the bus! Here we go! But the second thing I thought was, oh my gosh, this is exactly what they have young people who were moving into that community and would stay for 2 years and leave because they said it's like Teflon trying to get connected in this community. If you're not one of those 100, you can't get in. That is the Irish potato famine waiting to happen. If you have been in a board meeting recently where you have known how the whole conversation is going to go before one person even opened their mouth, you may be suffering from the Irish potato famine. Right? So, as we think about that handprint, right, as we think about what does Indianapolis need to do to attract and retain, step one is to just try to see the community, see the region as the next generation sees the region. And you have the good fortune of having an awesome resource and an awesome partner in this with Indy Hub. Molly Chavers is here. Where are you, Molly Chavers? A little higher in case people don't know, okay? Rock on. How many members now, Molly? 3,400 young professionals who are committed to making this region a better place to live and work, all hub through Molly Chavers' office and Indy Hub, right? You have young professionals who are saying, I want to be at the table, I want to make a difference. All of us want to make a difference in our community. But the question I have to ask is there a seat at the table? Is there a seat at the table? Think about this with your company. Think about the diaper commercial, the diaper story, right? Jim said this is wrong that a bunch of men are trying to figure out how to sell diapers to women, right? What we need to do is have the experience, see the experience as the next generation sees the experience. So for those of you who are managers or business owners or business leaders, Are you selling what the next generation wants to buy? Right? Does your policy and procedure manual say things like you will be eligible for vacation after 5 years? Right? Because the next generation isn't buying that. They saw their parents, workaholics, right, throw themselves on the sword for the company. For what? Right? They have a more nuanced view. They want to live balanced whole lives. Live first, work second. Right? They want to be engaged with a company that's about more than the bottom line. Shareholder value. I hate to be the first to tell you this, if I am. Shareholder value is not inspiring for a lot of your next generation workers. Right? Finding a cure for cancer. Right? Transforming educational institutions. Offering amazing patient care. Those things speak to the next generation. You've got to find that story within your organization. So as we think about airplanes, Jim at Cessna and his son saying, I'm going to move to Italy, as we think about diapers and how ridiculous it is for a bunch of men who haven't ever changed a diaper to try to sell that product to women, right, without having women at that decision-making table, and as we think about the Irish potato famine and the amount of genetic diversity required to propagate a species, and you think about that experience in your community, those are the three things I want to leave you with, right? Three things I want to leave you with. We're going to open it up now for a little Q&A. And I think, Steve, you are going to moderate that. Are you going to moderate it from right there?
Okay. If they turn on my mic, I will.
I think it's on. Can you hear him okay? Very good.
Good. Please discuss the importance of internships and the ways that college undergraduates can pursue this placement in Indiana or the Midwest.
Okay. On a scale of 0 to 100, this is a challenge question back. On a scale of 0 to 100, what percentage more likely are young people who have had an internship in a community, what percentage more likely are they to stay in Indianapolis if they've had an internship here? 0 to 100.
75
is right, cheater. Who? Of course.
Who's your college president?
Would you get out of my head? 75%. People who have had an internship are 75% more likely to stay in the community, right? What happens all too often at colleges and universities, certainly in the Midwest, but in other places as well, is sometimes the career guidance that's happening in our colleges and universities is guidance right out of the state. Oh, there are no opportunities in Indiana for people with your skill sets. Or if you really want a good job, you need to leave. Internships are the one real experiential way that we can prove that that is false. So with every community we work in, nearly everyone, especially if they have a college or university, we help design those systems that are going to connect those interns to the companies. Critical.
Here's a good one. Based on either your research or what you know about our community, could you just sort of give us a strengths and weaknesses?
You bet.
And some general guidance?
Okay. Here are the strengths. And by the way, my major work in your community has been with the arts organizations who have been asking, if the arts are so important to a community's coolness, how come it felt like we didn't have very many 20 and 30-somethings in our audiences? And for the last 3, going on 4 years now, we've been working through Greg's office to ensure that your arts organizations understand what the next generation wants. They want learning, they want connecting, they want multi-sensory experiences in the arts, which is slightly different than maybe what previous generations have asked for. So from an asset base, I will tell you, I feel very good about the community's commitment to arts and cultural experiences for the next generation, for your commitment to public art and all of those pieces. The other thing is, you know, again, over 4 years' time, you see things happen, right? And I know, you know, in Milwaukee, when we got the new art museum in southeastern Wisconsin, you know, some of you know it, right? It's got the retractable roof. You've got that on your dome, on your sports dome. We have it on an arts museum. But, you know, that became such an icon for the community. And I have to say that one of the great things that I think you've done over the course of the last 4 years that I've been knowing you is that you have invested in some things that are very iconographic for your community, right? So that first experience, like last night, that first experience of the airport, like, holy Toledo, that's really good stuff. Now, here's something that I would say is maybe, you know, a word of caution. And that is this. At the turn of the 19th going into the 20th century, in the late 1800s, Britain made a key decision, and that was this. Britain said, we're going to grow our economy by hanging on to our professional classes, which for them included primarily bankers and attorneys, and we're going to ship those sort of dirtier classes, right, or those lesser classes of technicians, including engineers, right, to this little country that we sort of overlook, which is India, right? So Britain made this decision that we want to have, you know, we want to have these professional classes, but the technical classes we want to move somewhere else. And now I'm pretty sure that the UK is thinking, what the hell have we done, right? Because attorneys and bankers have a very important role to play, but generally attorneys and bankers are there to protect innovation, not to create innovation. That is not something that we should be offshoring or sending other places. So it's always struck me as funny that when I come to Indianapolis, you know, one of the things when I talk about, so tell me about the professions here. How many people have said, we have more attorneys per capita here than like any other city our size? And, you know, I kind of want to say, with all deference to attorneys, who cares, right? I mean, take me to where your grittiest entrepreneurial centers are. Show me where your green-haired, glasses, punched-up, pierced, freak show innovators are. I want to see places where the thickness of the glasses is the measure of the cool, right? When I go to an innovation night here, what I sometimes see is a lot of people in dark suits. And I say, who are these people? And they say, well, they're the bankers and the attorneys. They're here to like, wah, wah, onto the innovators. So I think if there's one hope that I would have for Indiana, and it may be happening and I'm just not aware of it, but if there's one hope I have for this city and for this region, it is that we get more comfortable with people who don't look and dress and act like bankers and attorneys who are paid to protect. We need more people who are out on those fringes, who are paid to provoke, and who are there to push us, right, and guide us.
Last question. Just for the private employers, or maybe the public employers too, what are some of the easiest things we could do to be more relevant and more attractive to the next generation?
Yes. Okay, here's one thing. How are you hearing the voice of your next-gen talent? Some of our clients start what they call staff advisory boards or staff advisory councils. Sometimes it's only for their new hires. It might be for anybody who's 20-something or 30-something who's just thinking about the business a little bit differently. And they're having regular conversations about, you know, what could the company do differently, or, you know, how could we change so that we can attract more of you? Sometimes at Yahoo, for example, they give them a really specific task. All new hires are there to redo the career page of Yahoo so that it's stickier for that next generation talent that they're trying to attract. So that would be one thing. The other thing I can tell you is that when we ask next generation workers to force rank the things that matter the most to them in the workplace, life-work balance is number one. Life-work balance is number one, right? So if you currently have covenant periods around, you know, you can't take any vacation until your 20th anniversary or whatever it is, or because here's the thing that I always think is weird. People say, well, we couldn't give an extra week of vacation, or we couldn't, you know, allow flexible work. And I always say, why not? And I mean, unless you're working in healthcare, I mean, not everybody can be gone on the same day. I get that, right? But unless you're working in a very small number of fields, by changing people's hours or by offering another week of vacation, you are not telling them that they don't have to deliver, right? I know we offer 5 weeks of vacation to folks at our firm, and we expect their performance to not miss a beat, right? You're not saying we don't want you to perform. You're just saying we want you to have more time to enjoy your life. Right, more paid time off. So staff advisory board and looking at your life-work balance policies would be the two places I would start. Thank you, Steve.
That was Rebecca Ryan. She's the founder of Next Generation Consulting. Ryan's firm works with companies to help attract and keep young professionals. Jeb Banner is also concerned about keeping young, educated men and women in Indiana. He's the CEO of Smallbox, a web design and development company. Banner employs a lot of 20-something people in his company, and here he talks about Indianapolis and what the city needs to do to keep attracting young people to live and work in the city.
I think it's a nice mix of Bloomington and Chicago. Like, you get more of a big city, you get a lot of nice restaurants, you got a great art museum, you've got a lot of culture here, great music scene, which is, you know, Bloomington has that, and Chicago has that, but you don't get the insanity of a big city. So for me, with, you know, married with three kids, running my own business, like, Indianapolis is a complete haven. You know, it's very business friendly, low rent. We have an office in the middle of Broad Ripple. It's very affordable. So I find it very attractive. I think the main issue is there's not enough education nationally on the opportunities Indianapolis has. And that's why I'm very proactive about trying to get the word out about, you know, the music scene in particular through Musical Family Tree, because I feel that more people know about the music scene here. People in my age group, 20s and 30s, that's a big factor, is like, what's the music scene? Like Austin, San Francisco, you know, Athens, Georgia, all these different places, they've attracted the young smarties, as Rebecca said, to their cities, mostly because they've got a cool scene, the cool city factor. I think that Indianapolis is greatly underappreciated as a cool city. I think mostly the city needs to understand that our greatest assets are not the Motor Speedway and not the Colts and not the Pacers, to our demographic. Now, those are nice things, and they're like value-added things to people in their 20s and 30s, but they're not decision-makers for most people. They need to start seeing Broad Ripple and Fountain Square and, you know, like the Vogue, you know, obviously the IMA and the theaters here.
Jed Banner is the CEO of the Indianapolis web design and development company, Smallbox. You've been listening to another in a series of luncheon speakers at the Economic Club of Indiana, produced by Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations. The club's next speaker is best-selling author, columnist, and humorist P.J. O'Rourke. O'Rourke will address the club on January 21st on Why the State of Global Democracy Matters to Americans. I'm Mary Hartnett. Thanks for joining us.
Proliance Energy, providing natural gas to more than 1,200 commercial, industrial, utility, and municipal customers. Proliance, adding power to energy. Information is at proliance.com.